Hi, Dylan. Welcome to Melt the Snow Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We've lots of ground to cover today, but perhaps you could start by telling me about your experience of growing up in rural Connecticut without any electricity.
Well, the first 16 years of our life, we didn't have any power just because my parents didn't really want to have power. They started out having it, and they didn't want to deal with the bills, so literally my dad went and cut down the power pole. And we no longer had electricity even coming to the farmhouse at all, and it was like that for about 16 years. And then with the career path my mother was taking, she ended up needing to have electricity, put it that way, so we could be a little more up to code.
Right.
So we could fit in with what the government was trying to tell us at the time. And being that this was in the mid-80s, they weren't looking as hard as they do now, so you could get away with more things than you can now. So.
Roughly what decade are we talking about here? Are you 80s, yeah? Like from...
Yeah, the late 70s, early 80s.
Right. So pre-internet and all that, yeah.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Okay. I didn't start getting into the internet or even looking into too much of that till what, about 2000, to be honest. Even later, about 2004.
Okay, we're going to come back to the whole sustainability and farming the land, etc. later on in this chat. I just wanted to get a general context leading up to some of the stuff I'd like to talk to you about. As a lot of kids growing up in America, you went through the public schooling system. Just generally, what was your experience at the time? Were you aware of what was kind of going on, or did you just keep your head down and plow through it?
As my perspective, I would say it's a bit different than the typical American perspective, primarily because of the background growing up with no electricity and where I was coming from. I could sense an early disconnect even from the beginning, that it didn't seem correct. It didn't seem right that you should be listening to anybody that was separating you from your family. And I have one younger brother that I grew up with, and he was pretty much my only friend until we got into, until we started meeting other friends in the later years of our school life. So hanging around with my brother and my parents' friends, we were only treated as other adults almost our entire life. So we weren't treated as children. And we didn't have television to watch, so we didn't know how other children were treated. And we were always taught how everyone else was treated. So when we went to school and we were started to be put into categories and placed into grades, and you can only be with people around your same age, and you're starting to get tested and whatnot, that didn't make very much sense to me personally. So it was more of a go along to get along to see how this was going to where it was going to come to, but it never made too much sense. It never felt the way it should. So I was always questioning authority, and I had early indicators that it wasn't the way it was supposed to be, mainly just from teachers. The feedback I received, you're too aggressive, you're asking too many questions, stop getting too far ahead, you can't read ahead, you got to wait for everybody else. It didn't make sense. And even when they try to put you in higher place classes, which they try to meet your needs here when they can, and if you are in a school system where you can direct that much attention to you, where supposedly I was in one of those areas, even then they don't come close to meeting the needs that you would have if you had a mentor throughout your whole life, supposedly, like as it would have been like an elder grandparent or someone that was able to mentor you through your life and monitor those types of things. So upon completion of schooling, I went into some college, did a little bit of that. I quickly found out what kind of bunk that was. And, if they can talk about it, then why aren't they out doing it if they're that part of their life? It was that kind of school. So after that, I was pretty much faced with, you got to go make something of your life and do something. You're not going to be able to stay around here unless you make something of yourself. So my options at the time were to continue doing laborious work or go to school and listen to them, and I wasn't about to do that, so I took kind of what I thought at the time was the easy way out and joining the military. So I looked into the different branches of service and came out with the Air Force, being that it was similar to a job. There wasn't going to be any chance of going to the front line or doing that. Not that that was an issue. My whole initial beginning for going into the military was another avenue for paying for schooling. They had at the time the GI Bill, where they would give you X amount of dollars for going to college, and it was a pretty watered down version of what it is now. So I initially went in for the schooling. When I went in, I had a guaranteed job. I completely forget what that is at this now. I think it was something like carpentry or something like that, which I wish I had done now looking back. But halfway through basic training, we were offered any job we wanted, and if you completed certain courses and certain physical activities, you could be in special forces and do all that fun stuff. So I signed up for that, did that for a little while, found out that was a bunch of baloney, found out the military was baloney. The longer I was in it, the more that I saw that it was just a bunch of the old boys club kind of deal where everybody knew each other. And if you knew somebody, someone else would, you know, wash your hand if you washed their hand kind of deal. And it wasn't what I was looking for. So I was quick to get out of that.
So would it be right in saying that at that stage in your life, you either consciously or unconsciously bought into the concept of collectivism and the nation state, and it wasn't about individual autonomy and self-sustenance and all that. If that you needed this, protector, let's say, to guard the boundaries of threat and whatever the military propaganda is, did you believe in that, or was it something that was, as you said, it was just a job and like, if I just keep my head down, I can get through this? Or did that matter to you at the time? I suppose the propaganda around the military and you're an all-American patriot or whatever, this is what you do to be a righteous, moral, stand-up man in society.
Absolutely. It's continually reinforced. For instance, this town of Coventry that I live in, Nathan Hale Homestead is the character that's from Coventry. He was in the Revolutionary War. He's known for his statement saying, "I regret I have but one life to give for my country," because he was caught as a spy in England, spying for the Americans. So the schools are named after him here. Cool. Everything, they have Captain Nathan Hale Day. That's one of the things that's portrayed around here. And on top of that, it's more of everything's pushed upon you that you could do more for the state than you can do for yourself.
I get the sense that, you know, from the kind of Hollywood version of what it means to be in the military, it's all very sanitized and it's all couched in this kind of righteous, moralistic tones. All of the devastation and collateral damage is conveniently, you know, obscured from view. Did you start bumping up against those effects in your day-to-day involvement, or was it, if you out dared to ask those questions or even, you know, speak to your peers about it, were you marginalized, or is that what you did at all, or did you find that this was an internal conflict that you just felt that you had to resolve yourself and then withdraw?
When I was in the military, I didn't have so much of an awakening as I do now. It was more of, I didn't like listening to other people telling me what to do, and I could clearly tell they had no idea what they were talking about in the first place. So I didn't even like that structure of authority to begin with. It was laid out incorrectly. I could clearly tell that it was incorrect. So I questioned it enough to get out of there, so where I thought I would have more freedoms to do what I wished once I left the military. And only after going into the business world for 10 or 12 years did I realize that I finally started waking up to all of it.
Okay.
I would have asked separate questions and much different questions if I had the amount of awareness I do now back then. And that was, let's see, I've been out of the military for 15, 20 years now, so.
Do you want to just follow on then about your re-engagement with civilian activity as such in the business and world, and how you interacted with that infrastructure? And you were saying there that you started to kind of have some realizations about the more nefarious aspects of business, maybe, or that there was an agenda at play which you began to understand.
That was on the later part of my business career. Upon leaving the military, I moved to Colorado, and I was doing construction for a few years, where I started with a construction company, worked my way up, saw how evil they were in treating their employees, was able to stay on until they started to get rid of everybody, and then right before it got busy, I left them too. So I left them like they left my friends. That was my way to say goodbye to that. And that was the last time I think I've ever worked for anyone else. And that really set me into, where's this all coming to? Where's it all going? And my quest for more information. And that's when I really started to open my eyes to see what's happening. I was starting to questioning a lot more things, because basically I was running around bumping myself into everybody, trying to figure out, who am I? What's going on? And this is one of the ways I was pushed into doing that.
Okay, so you somehow reached out to Richard Grove, who's the founder of Tragedy and Hope, and you found that the media he was producing and the community around that, you found some kind of gateway towards understanding what was going on in a more coherent way. Just to say for people listening who don't know what Tragedy and Hope is, I just have a little extract from the website here. It says, Tragedy and Hope is a website and online community founded by Richard Grove, which creates educational media and provides a comprehensive, cogent, open source educational model for adults, providing individuals with access, tools, and resources to attain coherent perspectives at and beyond PhD level.
Yes, last summer, I believe it was, I just basically contacted them and agreed to, they invited me over to their house. I came over, and I reintroduced myself to Lisa. It had been a few years, probably about 20 years at least, since we'd seen or talked to each other. It didn't seem like it was more than a couple days by the time we'd been there for more than 5 minutes. And after telling them that I had ingested all of their material that he has online, pretty much all the podcasts, I've gone through everything. I mean, I did podcast 88 last week, and that was fantastic if you haven't gotten to it yet. And after introducing myself and hanging out with them, I volunteered in any way possible to do what I could, being that I'm not too far from them and they don't have too many people that are in this direct area that are of the same age, that have the same kind of knowledge and are willing to help in any manner possible, which I am in any way that I can. Just the message is more important to me. As Rich has said in the past, the reason that he created the whole scenario was because no one else had done before him. No one else has put something together that he has in the manner that he has for everyone to easily digest it.
Yeah, it's a massive undertaking to dig into this stuff. And I found that once I started to understand that this was for my own edification, my own understanding of reality, that I just became excited now about this stuff, where some of the episodes are like 10, 15 hours long. If they're consumable, you can take on it as a project almost and go, look, this topic has got maybe 7 or 8 different passages, and it might take you 1 week or 2 weeks to get through an episode. What I found was the most enjoyable aspect of it was that for the first time, because when I started getting into this stuff, I don't know if you experienced this as well, that there's this kind of shutdown mode from people who don't necessarily understand this, and it's just, it's all conspiracy. And I found that my initial digging into this stuff maybe 5-6 years ago, there's lots of kind of rabbit holes you go down and they just lead to this kind of dead end. But the Tragedy and Hope platform was the first time it was like, somebody's worked this out now. You know, somebody's got a mature intellectual philosophical understanding of this stuff and has taken the time, energy and commitment to lay it out in a very accessible educational way. And I just, like, for me, it was a game changer. You know, I'd urge anyone listening to this to dig into the stuff, particularly the Peace Revolution podcast. They fundamentally change how you will interact with philosophy. I don't know what you call it, but it's kind of understanding reality, really. May I just ask, like, out of all of the topics and areas that they cover, was there any particular area that really resonated with you?
The episode that he did with Leo Biscali. He was a motivational speaker, and it's more about connecting with people on a personal level, every single person you come in contact with. And Leo's thing was, no matter who came and saw him, and it would be whoever came and saw him speak, and it would be up to 50 people, up to a couple thousand, he would stay and hug every single person after they left. Every right. person he's ever met, he's hugged. So he's that kind of person. So I don't know where Rich found his work, but that one touched me in more ways than I could possibly imagine. But after that, it's John Taylor Gatto's work. That was okay. Mind-blowing to me. What he opened up to me about the, I call it the industrial complex instead of the military-industrial complex. Now you have the educational-industrial complex. And to me, that's bigger than the military-industrial complex because that's what trains it. That's what we all have to go through to worship the military in this country.
I'd like to get back to what you're doing now, Dylan. You decided to focus your attention more towards autonomy, self-reliance. You work on a farm, I believe, in Coventry.
Upon discovering Tragedy and Hope, I was out in Colorado still. After becoming aware of that information, I've made the adjustments to my current that situation to find myself in this current situation I'm in now, where I've returned to the farm that I grew up on, and I'm in the process of semi-restoring it, making it autonomous on its own. And at the same time, I'm applying some of the principles of trying to provide three times as much with what you have. I originally found out about it through Michael Tellinger and his work with Ubuntu, where you have three times amount of your inventory, essentially. So whatever you're good at, whatever your talent is, you produce three times as much of that. I like to eat good vegetables and healthy vegetables, so that was the first forte that I looked into. So I figured by growing three times as much vegetables, I would be able to have twice as much that I would need for myself, and I'd be able to give away one whole third of it and still have more than enough than I could need. So it's really, it's about building up your inventory to kind of put together a business so you could have stuff to barter with. So the method that I came up with for growing my vegetables was a form of permaculture, because being that it would be a one or two person show, it wouldn't be a big production per se. I was looking for methods that would leave me with the most amount of time possible and still give me the best results, which pretty much everyone does about everything. Well, upon the discoveries that I found, the easiest method for basically every type of gardening was what they call layer gardening, or for some people, lasagna gardening, where you put one type of material here and then another one on top of it and another one on top of it, and the plant will reach through those layers of material. The plant roots will reach through there and get the substances they need. The beauty of that is the way you structure the layers, you no longer have to weed and you no longer have to water throughout almost the entire season. So it's basically you do all your prep work and getting stuff ready in the spring, which right now, and then probably about the middle of June, I'm done for the rest of the year except for just eating and clean up in the fall. So that leaves me plenty more time to go do much other activities as far as getting other things ready for the fall and the next crop and then onto the next thing. So it's really just observing what other people are doing, and they were showing what their experience was, and I took in what they were able to offer, and now I'm implementing those same ideas. The way that I do it when I'm able to find someone that's willing to barter when I do need a service, for instance, I don't no longer have a wood chipper, and I require wood chips as the form of one of the layers that I require for the gardening. So what I put an ad on Craigslist, and my maple syruping that I did in the winter time, I have maple syrup that goes for, if you were to put a dollar value to it, you're looking at about $75 to $100 per gallon of it. So I would offer, say, I need a couple loads of wood chips, I would say, here's a gallon of maple syrup. Let's trade across the board, because for most of the tree companies, wood chips is an excess for them. They're just looking for a place to get rid of it. So if you can look for where the needs and wants are and kind of fill those in with some of your other ones, and it just takes a little time to get that system together. But once it's together, it's natural. It's naturally how we all do. We're just filling in for the parts that other people aren't willing to do. But the more that we're capable of on our own, the less we're going to need from other people. And then we're just exchanging the few objects we may need for that little bit of time. The rest of the time, we're exchanging ideas and looking for ways to improve upon stuff.
Brilliant. I love it. I think it's fantastic. The other product you mentioned there was maple syrup. Could you talk me through how it arrives on the, on the breakfast table from the origin?
My pleasure. Okay, so maple syrup, and it's particularly pertains to the eastern coast of North America. So it has to be in a maple tree, a sugar maple tree particularly. They have 2% sugar in them, whereas most other trees only have 1% sugar. So now what I'm getting at with that is, in order to produce 1 gallon of pure maple syrup, you need roughly 40 to 45 gallons of maple sap. So as opposed to like a birch tree, which would be 100 gallons. So you'd have to collect twice as much water. It's basically just sugar water. So what you would do, you would go and locate the maple trees. You have to be able to identify your trees, and they're pretty prolific around here. There's lots of sugar maple trees in this region. This is the type of climate they enjoy, and the soil is perfect for them. So what you do is you locate your tree, and it has to be the season. You have to be able to recognize the season when the sap begins to run. It's generally the beginning of March, April, right around there. You got to go by the temperatures, and the length of the day also will do it. But the temperature has to be correct for the sap to unfreeze and then freeze again. And as it unfreezes in the morning when the sun's hot enough to pull up the nutrients from the roots, that's when the sap starts to run up the tree. And that's when you locate your tree. You would go out to the tree, take a drill, drill a hole in there about 2 inches in there, and you have this metal tap that you literally tap in there. and it has a hook on it, and you put the tap in there, and almost immediately, if this, you know, it's the sun's usually out, it's warm enough, the tap, the sap will immediately start running out there. So you put your can under there, it starts filling up, and then you go and, depending on the size of your collecting bucket, you either pick up once a day or twice a day. They have a couple of different methods now where they have hoses running out to all the trees. You don't have to do that kind of stuff, but we still use the collection of the can. So you would go and tap as many trees as you could possibly, however many taps you have, however many trees you have. This year I did 70 trees by myself. Last year I only did 20 and I got about a gallon and a half of syrup. This year I did 70 trees and I got about 13 gallons of maple syrup. So I boiled down 13 times. So once you collect more than 40 gallons of sap, you would want to boil down. And the sooner you do it, the fresher the sap is going to be. So I was trying to boil down every day, every other day, and boil down so you have at least a gallon, because once you boil down the 40 gallons in one size, a decent sized pan, that 1 gallon of maple syrup on the bottom is real thin and it can flash. It could actually burn up because it could be sugar. If you get sugar hot enough, that will burn. The way that it's gauged to know when it's maple syrup, I do it by sight now, but the correct way would be when the temperature of the sap has reached 219 degrees, then it's pure maple syrup. If you continue to go above that, that's when it gets real fun. You start to get caramel, then you get like a soft hard candy, then a middle hard candy, then like a hard candy, then almost straight sugar that'll like, you can feel it just like melting through your teeth when you put it in there. It's that strong a sugar. And the flavor is just phenomenal. If you've never had pure maple syrup without the, you know, the fructose corn syrup in there, just pure maple syrup, it's the ultimate. Drinking the sap is incredibly good for you as well, because it's essentially nature's Gatorade. When you're trying to drink extremely clean water, most people will try to put it through type of Berkey filters or any type of filters where we're trying to take out the fluoride taste, all these other things out of there. Well, if you were to filter your water through a tree, I'm pretty sure that's going to be about the healthiest water you're going to get, not to mention the added extras that naturally come from the tree. So really, that's pretty much the best stuff that you could have. And it just happens to be that it comes out in the springtime when you would be deficient after a long winter of only being able to eat the food that was available or that you managed to store through the winter. So nature just automatically provides this stuff for us. And so the way that it came to where we're using it in the culture now, it was originally discovered when we observed the Indians would go around and they'd make gashes in the trees and literally just drink the syrup, the sap right out of there. They had gourds that they grew in the summertime. A gourd is a type of pumpkin, and they grow in oblong kind of shapes. And certain ones you can hollow out real easy, and the husk of it or the shell of it stays preserved for quite a long time. You can make them into birdhouses and whatnot. Well, these Indians would grow these gourds, hollow them out, and make they'd make cookware out of them. And it would be their plates or their bowls, or they would use them to collect the sap. So they'd grow gourds, and then they hang the gourds on the trees in the springtime, collect the sap, boil it down. They wouldn't necessarily boil it down to get the 40 gallons to 1 gallon of maple syrup, but even if you boil down a little bit, you have some sweet water that's going to obviously replenish you a lot faster than normal water would out of the stream. I know when you do the pure maple syrup, if you boil it down correctly, that should stay preserved for at least a year. Now, if you boil it down even further, it's almost pure sugar, and that's almost never going to go bad. See, the trick with the stuff that they make in the store, when they started adding extras to it, that then you're going to have to preserve that. That's the one key that I've learned the most on my food journey is how are they preserving all the food in all the supermarkets, even the stuff at the farmer's market. You're not going to have something you can grow organic and keep it on a stand for 7 days and have it still look the way it was when you picked it. It just doesn't work that way. So especially when you're going to try to ship something even just across the country, it's 5 days in a hot truck or on a hot train or in a plane or whatever, it's just going to rot. So how is all this stuff showing up at the shelf still looking edible and not rotting? What are they doing that I can't do, that anyone couldn't do, that's special to make their stuff last longer? And why is that a secret? How come that isn't something we can all do? So if that's being hidden from us, why? I'm usually up around 4:30, 5 o'clock every morning. I get up, just walk outside for a little bit, see what it's like. I obviously live in the woods, so I just walk around the deck a little bit, see how the air is going to be. Then I go into the main house where my parents are. I do the fruit juice in the morning, and it'll be a little bit of ginger, kiwi, grapefruit, orange, apple, and pear. And then after that, I usually walk my four-legged fruit friends here. They go for a good hike in the woods. Once we're done with that, it's usually about 7:30 or so. Then I walk around, tend to the gardens, see what needs to be tending to for the morning type of attention. And it's mainly watering, see if there's any infestation of any plants or anything like that. Then it's on to whatever kind of laborious work I have for the day. And that usually will involve putting together more gardens, chopping some wood, any kind of thing that to most people would seem laborious. And when I first started doing it, I thought that same way, but now it's not. It's what I enjoy. It's a workout. It's a type of meditation. I'll do that until about noontime or whenever I start getting hungry, going, and then I have my shake. That's my base. I got to have that every day because that's like taking my medicine. If you were to had to take pills every day, I would take the shake instead. So that consists of like a half a cup of flaxseed that I grind up first, so they're broken up so they're not just passing through, and then a spoonful of chia seeds, then some nutritional yeast fortified with B12, then a little bit of spirulina. Then I have this, it's a mega green mix that we have at the local co-op here, where it's a whole bunch of dried up dandelion root and alfalfa grass, and I put a scoop of that in there. Then I put raw coca in there, then some roasted coca beans, just a little bit of those, two coconut-covered dates, and then a couple of bananas, and then I try to get hemp milk. That's my favorite. I try to top it off with hemp milk and then just put it all together, and that's my drink every day.
Because this is all tying together with your relationship with acquiring knowledge and discerning fact from fiction and attaining certainty and autonomy. Can you link this back into your relationship with food and nutrition and wellness and your general health?
Certainly. My primary reason for even looking into it in the first place was I was awake to the awareness that I wanted to, that this was only one body. You only have one. Why would you want to put lousy gas in a great engine that you have forever? So I started looking for the optimal food that would make my body be the healthiest it could possibly be. It really began with the notion of, I no longer want to have any health care. I don't want to go to the hospital. Not that I was forced with that in the beginning, but I didn't want that to be on the menu at all. And as I continued upon it and found more information, I began to slowly look at trying to find the max amount of nutrients you could get through whatever available means that were available to everybody pretty much. And as I went through the grocery store and went along that journey of, seeing what was in the ingredients, what they were putting together, how they were getting that process as it came together, and how they were able to present it and keep it preserved. Once again, it's the preservation of it. And the more I looked into that, it kept coming back to the longer the shelf life, the shorter yours is, pretty much. I was doing this discovery of the food journey at about the same time I was doing the discovery of the monetary system. So the two of them pretty much go together because they're both uses as measures of control against you, and one you need, the other one you don't. And they're trying to use one over the other one. Well, you can just do away with the money one entirely and just use food. And why can't you just use that as a method of currency? Or they use it as a form of control, obviously, but just currency. So if you have an abundance of food and it's good food, that's wealth pretty much. And then that correlates into along with the food journey, that goes to your health is your wealth. So the food, if you want to be healthy, you want to be wealthy, you have to have the correct food to do it. So that was part of my whole awakening. And in addition to that, in order to think correctly and have cognitive freedom, your body has to be in optimal condition as well. If your body's not functioning correctly, your mind is part of your body and it won't function correctly. So if your body is kind of subpar, it's going to bring your brain into that foggy part and you won't think clearly. So that was the first part of my awakening. I go, okay, if I got to think correctly, my body's got to be in the correct form, first of all, because if I don't have control of one, how can I have control of the other? And that right there is an easy indicator to know who is truly in control of their actions and everything they do. That's why food is such a big part of the social interaction. If you're sitting down with four or five people and one person's not eating what everyone else is eating, people look at them, why aren't you eating what we're eating? Because that makes us feel not safe. What was your reason for not choosing what we're eating and putting in our bodies that could possibly is going to continue our life or kill our life? So that's a huge social friction right there. And if you were to look at the logical way of how it came to be and how it all, what the reason for putting it in your body and how it comes to be, it's eventually just someone being greedier, wanting more than you want.
Could you summarize or give the listeners any kind of key insights you have? You've been doing this for 3 or 4 years. What's the key insight you would give or take away from this journey towards health and wellness?
The portion size. That's the number one thing that you'll be able to maintain forever. It doesn't matter really what you're always putting in. Yeah, you're going to want to always find the healthiest stuff you can put in there, but it's truly the portion size that helps me the most. And it's always the size of your fist or whatever can fit in your hand. That's about the most that should be on your plate at any type of meal. That's the thing that's helped me the most. That, and then one thing that I'm amazed that if you want to have clarity of mind, fast for a day, skip a few meals. I don't think I've ever taken drugs that have given me that type of clarity. That's amazing. And if you look back in history, fasting was one of the ways to heal yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I come to that awareness as well. It's called, I don't know if you're familiar with intermittent fasting. It's basically integrating as part of your weekly cycle, extended periods of not eating into effectively your daily routine. So you fast for maybe 16 hours or so, and then you eat in an 8-hour window. And exercising, what do you actively kind of exercise in as opposed to leisure exercise? But do you have anything there that, I said in the last few years that you've had a new awareness of that works? Or
yes, when I initially started my journey on my way to health, I was starting to get into the longer runs. I was doing the 5 or 6 miles every day. Then I was building. I started to do a couple of those extreme marathons where they're, running half of a marathon and then biking another marathon and swimming and doing a bunch of other stuff. And the way that made me feel the few days after that, your body was just wrecked. So I started making the comparison that if you're running your engine at red line all the time, you're wearing out your body prematurely. It's nice to go out and clean the pipes every now and then, to run every now and then to clean them out. But to do that prolonged for an extended period of time, you're really just ending your life sooner than it's meant to be. You're burning out faster than it can be. So I slowed back from that. I was pretty intense with my workouts before I came back to the farm. And my idea was, once I got here, I knew there was level of amount of work that needed to be completed, physical activity and physical labor. I wanted to see if that would be enough to keep me in the shape that I was when I first got here, based on the conditioning I was doing elsewhere. Well, it sure is. It's more than enough. It's the physical activity that I can keep myself with busy around here every day. It goes with the seasons as well, too. For instance, we use wood to heat the house, to heat most of our stuff. So I got to go out and cut it with a chainsaw. We got a little four-wheeler that we bring it here, but I still got to split. We have a log splitter, but I'd rather split it all myself. So I split almost 10 cord every year by hand. Right. So there's a couple months of staying in shape. There's always something to do to stay in shape.
Just to get back then to your interaction with this new form of media, the online media producers, and there's, outside of Trudging Hope, there's hundreds of alternative media producers creating authentic content. Who else have you dug into or checked out and has, affected how you perceive what's going on?
Well, there was a few that are based out of the Tragedy and Hope community. Obviously, Mark Passio with his What on Earth is Happening. Most of his material, I'm just starting to finish up his podcast. I would say Mark would probably be the easiest for anyone in the street to understand on any topic, pretty much. He could take most topics and bring them down to the street level experience where he's able to put it in simple enough language for anyone to follow. And the message he is portraying is basically to just tell you what's exactly happening on Earth, as that's why he said, What on Earth is Happening? Mark Rose, The Most Dangerous Superstition, his work is excellent. His book portrays the message of how the fraud of the state and the government and what it really is and how that is pushed upon us, and that it's just a belief that everyone believes in, just like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. And he's another person that's right up there with Rich and Mark as far as trying to get the message out, the same exact message of freedom that we're all trying to pursue. Another person that I found to be quite the wordsmith, and he was also speaker at Free Your Mind 3, was Clint Richardson. His work has been quite exceptional. He really gets into the etymology of a lot of the words, and I find that extremely valuable. He does more of the – he'll take a few dictionaries and break down words, whereas Mark will use the same words in green language. You can compare and contrast between the two of those guys and see the difference for yourself.
Okay.
To follow up would be James Corbett. He has the Corbett Report, and he is more of a, I almost say, a day-to-day kind of news person. He's skimming all the news over the whole planet and putting it together for you on a daily or somewhat daily basis. I value his work because he sources it correctly, and he doesn't really have much of an opinion on it, but he's pretty straightforward with the truth, and he's extremely well in telling it.
Okay. A lot of those are in what I'd call the geopolitical categories and
yes.
or socio-political. Have you come into other arenas of awareness yet, or are you mindful of the more esoteric, mystic, Gnostic categories yet, or is that something that's on your radar that you've yet to dig into in more detail?
More detail, yes. I'm scratching the surface on a few things, but I need to get into more detail on it.
Yeah. That's I just found in speaking with other people about this stuff that that's a whole other project almost that needs to be absorbed and understood and then connected back into the mainstream culture plays out, and that there's a huge connection between, you know, let's call it esotericism and what's obscured from common knowledge against what's been played out in the geopolitical arena. I'm now kind of speaking about stuff that I've checked out, but you know, from speaking to you, it's a huge area of interest, and I'm kind of reluctant to say check one thing out, because I find that once you get into one area, as you did with Tragedy and Hope, all of the rest start to unfold naturally.
Yes.
And it becomes a journey of self-discovery in that sense. And for me, that's where my ongoing journey of discovery, let's say, has led me into at the moment. I keep going back to the center path, as I call it. And I constantly check out Peace Revolution and Mark Passio and all those guys. But I occasionally and more frequently now, I veer way off course, and I'm checking out all sorts of stuff on Freemasonry and occultism and magic, the practice of magic itself, and all this kind of stuff, which to your average person might look at and go, that's just silly, that's all just, you know, nonsense. But the more you dig into it, the more you understand that this stuff is, you know, is
there's
so interesting.
Here.
It's just so interesting. Like it's just the history behind it. Like even Freemasonry itself, I've no interest in becoming a Freemason, and I look at it just as you were saying from an observation point of view, and it exists in reality. There are people who practice as Freemasons. It has a massive historical legacy across all cultures, well, in Western culture, let's say, and it's pretty much unknown to your average person. People have maybe a very vague understanding of what Masonry is, but man, there's just so much there. Like it's rich with intrigue, history, knowledge, hidden knowledge, political agenda, culted knowledge. Like it's just got everything. Like it's an amazing.
And that's just one.
And that's just one. That's Freemasonry alone. It crosses into so many other areas of civilization. It's a never ending rabbit hole, you know. And that's just one of them. Cool. Well, I'm going to start wrapping it up, Dylan. I'd like to ask you one question. And if you were to summarize how your worldview has changed in recent years, what's the big picture here that I used to think this, now I think this? What is
sure.
it?
Sure. Yep. I used to think the world was horrible and everything was going to hell. Now I see that it's nothing but love and everybody wants the best. That's what's happening.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I've learned from mine. The one thing that I've learned from what everyone that's gone through this journey and has come back, supposedly, the number one thing that they've all say is be kind, because you're never going to remember what you said, what you did, what you felt. But if you're always kind, everyone's going to be kind to you, because you don't know where they came from, what they did, but just be kind. Always remember that and you'll be fine.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I'll say bye-bye and thank you so much. I hope to speak to you again.
Yes, hopefully. Pleasure.
Cheers, man.
See ya.